KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. We're continuing to dive into the history of Oak Flat, a site sacred to Native people. Located in Arizona, it may soon be home to one of the largest copper mines in the world. Apache people continue to fight to protect it. KJZZ's Gabriel Piatarazio reports.
An 1871 order from President Ulysses S. Grant established the San Carlos Apache Reservation. This led to rounding up thousands of Apaches, including Geronimo, and marching them to Hell's 40 Acres under military occupation. Some even refer to it as a concentration camp. At that time, the U.S. viewed Apaches as a monolith, but these communities are made up of complex kinship networks of bands and clans, like Tonto, Yavapai, Chiricahua, and many more. Mactima says not all of them got along.
Obviously, when you bring all these different people together on a reservation, there's going to be some ancient cultural clashes, because there was no Apache nation that didn't exist. We wouldn't have ever confined ourselves in that way at all.
Here's history professor Shepard.
So you get this flurry of executive orders, but it's also tied with the just horribly violent clampdown on Apaches in the Southwest. They're really waging a military, but also a bureaucratic war on Apaches as a people, but also upon their land.
Their reservation changed size 6 times, and Mactima says mineral wealth was a driving motivator.
And of course, that means the extermination of Apache peoples in the region.
Shepard says that's not hyperbole.
Rounding people up, concentrating them on reservations, deporting them. And as that happens, we start to see the emergence of that federal land management regime take over the territory as public domain.
In 1955, President Dwight D. Eisenhower incorporated Oak Flat into the Tonto National Forest, where it remains to this day. And Mactima believes if Apaches remained nomadic and weren't restricted to reservations,
Oak Flat would still become a very prominent place for Apaches to travel to.
Gabriel Piatarazio, Phoenix.
Devastating wildfires across western Canada have forced thousands of people from their homes, including those in Indigenous communities. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, for many First Nations, the crisis is one of temporary accommodation.
According to the latest statistics, and they change quickly, more than 30,000 people in Saskatchewan and Manitoba have been forced to leave their homes and are displaced. Hundreds of homes have been destroyed, many Indigenous people have been flown out of remote communities, and satellite images show that in some regions the situation is worsening. In Winnipeg, Manitoba's largest city, there isn't much left. Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs Grand Chief Kyra Wilson says the situation has become dire.
And we see young children and families waiting in whatever environment that they're in, waiting to go to, you know, their secondary accommodation, whatever that is, whether that's one of the congregate shelters, whether that's a hotel, whether that's out of province. And it's really sad to see, you know, our children having to sleep on floors. People are sitting, waiting in hallways, waiting outside. And right now, we just need everybody to come together.
In Ottawa, the federal government has deployed military personnel to help fight the fires. Officials say the firefighting service has now been stretched to the maximum, and the call has gone out to Canada's international partners for help. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian Country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
They would be, I think, a huge loss to not only the sort of wildlife field as a whole, but also to every university that has one.
Advocates worry about federal cuts to wildlife research programs in Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 6th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, officials balance enthusiasm and skepticism amid a federal push for a natural gas pipeline.
An agreement to have a project move forward that's going to benefit Alaskan. That's what I want.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
More than 1,000 people from around the world gathered in Anchorage this week for the fourth annual Alaska Sustainable Energy Conference. Across 3 days of panels and talks, the specter of the long-sought Alaska gas line loomed large. As KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports, the megaproject still faces a lot of outstanding question marks.
Sitting in gray armchairs with a large image of a moose behind them, Governor Mike Dunleavy and Glenfarne CEO Brian Duvall came together on the last day of the conference to reflect and ruminate on the literal pipe dream.
Okay, I'm going to ask the question that I probably shouldn't ask. Confidence level. Are we going to have a pipeline here in a few years?
Well, I see every reason why we will, and I've come here and I've put my name on it. And when I put my name on something, I'm stuck. I've got to get it done. And the fundamentals allowed me to do that with good decision-making, not rolling the dice. So the answer is yes.
Duvall says his company is taking the Alaska LNG project one step at a time. He's the founder and CEO of Glenfarne, which assumed majority ownership of the project from the state of Alaska earlier this year.
There are three phases. Each of them can reach their final investment decision, attract capital in independent financings. And so these are really bite-sized financings.
The three phases correspond to the three elements of the project: an 800-mile pipeline, a liquefaction and export facility in Nikiski, and a North Slope gas treatment plant. The project's been floated for decades, but the steep cost, $44 billion at last count, has stymied any real progress. Glenfarne recently announced Worley Limited as the company that will update the project cost to $2025. Glenfarne has a stated goal of bringing on investors by the end of the year. Also this week, the company announced a cohort of potential investors that Glenfarne says have, quote, expressed interest in the project. But what it really needs is buyers. U.S. Energy Secretary Doug Burgum suggested during a Sunday roundtable in Anchorage, investors will fall in line once buyers sign on.
If we get offtake agreements, if we sell energy to our Pacific allies, there will be people lined up to finance it. We won't take foreign capital to build the pipeline. There may be foreign interest in wanting to be part of it because it's going to be a great project. But what we really need is customers.
But as of Thursday, there aren't any offtake agreements. Not any binding ones, anyway. Earlier this year, Glenfarne and Dunleavy celebrated a letter of intent from Taiwan's state-owned CPC Corporation, signed while the governor toured Asia to promote the project. Pan Mon An, a high-level Taiwanese official, says the project is his country's, quote, best choice for building energy resilience.
More importantly, and another reason why I'm here today, the government of Taiwan is ready to expand its procurement of natural gas, agricultural goods, and industrial products from the United States. Alaska stands at the center of this endeavor.
If built, Menon said the project could become Taiwan's, quote, primary source of energy. Right now, the United States accounts for about a tenth of Taiwan's liquefied natural gas imports. But Taiwan isn't the only country expressing interest. U.S. cabinet members joined delegates from Japan, the Philippines, and South Korea for a tour of the heart of Alaska's oil and gas economy during a Monday visit to the North Slope. And the Kenai Peninsula Borough's mayor says he's hosted his own slew of international delegations in recent months. But some, like Nikiski Republican Senator Jesse Bjorkman, say they're ready to see some tangible results.
Enthusiasm doesn't equal a decision to invest in a project, doesn't equal an agreement to have a project move forward that's going to benefit Alaskan. That's what I want.
Even Duvall agrees turning the pipeline dream into a reality is a tall order.
There's no doubt this is going to be really, really hard and a lot of angst, but it really is a tremendous opportunity, and I invite everyone in the room to be part of it and step forward where you want to be involved.
He says his strategy is a simple one. Never give up. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
President Trump's proposed budget for next year seeks to cut a wildlife research program that produces data for state fish and game departments across the country. Now, outdoor recreators, wildlife managers, scientists, and students involved with Alaska's program are raising the alarm over its potential disappearance. The Alaska Desk's Shelby Herbert reports.
Most states have what's called a Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. Their purpose is to help state wildlife managers answer big conservation questions. Alaska's Co-op Research Unit asks questions like, how do we maintain the dwindling 40-mile caribou herd? Or how do we get rid of the invasive northern pike that are chowing down on juvenile salmon? It serves as a training ground for many of the state's current and future wildlife biologists, and it produces scads of useful data about the animals that regular folks care about.
It's very applied research.
Kevin Fraley is on the board of directors for the Alaska chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and he worked with the program when he was a student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where the state's research unit is housed. He says the unit doesn't just focus on the sort of esoteric research that might only interest scientists.
So usually something that's really useful for like moose or salmon, you know, these species that are so important for Alaskans, for hunting, for livelihood, for subsistence and all that.
The program was created by federal law almost a century ago. It's a collaboration between state, university, and federal biologists to build up wildlife data to support fish and game management. But Trump's proposed budget for 2026 calls for the complete elimination of the funding that supports the unit. The potential loss of the program, on top of cuts to other sources of federal grant funding for research, has many of the Alaska Co-op unit's students and partners feeling unsteady. Chris Krenz is a wildlife scientist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
The unit has done a tremendous amount of research that has been very informative to wildlife management in Alaska. The unit has helped us understand the importance of both habitat and predators in regulating game populations, for example.
According to UAF, about half of the graduate students who studied in its research co-op unit in the last decade have gone on to work in fish and wildlife management in Alaska. Krenz says the unit is a key pipeline for fish and game, and that some of his department's most successful and impactful staff came straight from the program.
These are people that have come and spent time in Alaska, really gotten to know Alaska by doing their research and studies here in Alaska. So we have a lot stronger sense that these folks will come to the job knowing what they're getting themselves into.
Diane O'Brien is the director of UAF's Institute of Arctic Biology, and she works closely with the co-op unit. She says the program is also an important lifeline for her students, and if it went away,
there would be many fewer students that could be supported in their pursuit of master's and PhDs in wildlife biology and fisheries as well.
Derek Arnold is among them. He's a postdoctoral researcher studying wolf populations in southeast Alaska. He says the state's hiring freeze has further discouraged his peers from sticking around.
I feel like currently people are just sort of in a bit of stasis. They would be, I think, a huge loss to not only the sort of wildlife field as a whole, but also to every university that has one.
And as for himself, Arnold says the co-op unit is one of the main reasons he came to Alaska from the lower 48. but he says he's not sure how long he'll be able to stick around if the program folds. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
A polar icebreaker is destined for what will eventually be its new home port in Juneau. It set out on Tuesday from Pascagoula, Mississippi, on its maiden voyage as an official U.S. Coast Guard vessel, according to a news release. The 360-foot ship is built to operate in the Arctic and is meant to increase U.S. presence in the region. The Coast Guard estimates it will bring hundreds of Coast Guard personnel and their families to Juneau in the coming years. The ship was previously named the IVIC. It was renamed the Storrs in honor of another Coast Guard ship that was stationed in Juneau in the 1950s. The Storrs is intended to serve as a stopgap while the Coast Guard builds a new fleet of icebreakers called Polar Security Cutters. It's the first icebreaker the Coast Guard has acquired in more than 25 years. It's not a new ship. Coast Guard bought it for $125 million from a private entity late last year. A ProPublica investigation of the ship published earlier this year found it has a design problem and a history of failure. It's expected to arrive in Juneau this August, but it will leave again to be temporarily berthed in Seattle until the necessary shore infrastructure is finished in Juneau. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Sitka Sound Science Center welcomes a rare stubby mollusk.
And she definitely sees us, so she's now blowing back at us to try and tell us to back up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers a variety of personalized and relevant hands-on degree programs with close mentorship from exceptional faculty. At APU, students are the core of a tight-knit and supportive community invested in their academic success. Education is collaborative, innovative, and transformational, encouraging student development and honoring Indigenous heritage. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
A 600-foot cargo ship that caught fire on Tuesday near the remote Aleutian island of Adak is still burning. The crew of the Morning Midas was rescued with no injuries, but the ship is adrift in the North Pacific with potentially hazardous cargo aboard. The Morning Midas was reportedly carrying over 3,000 vehicles, some of them electric. Adak City Manager Brett Craig says he's concerned about the ship drifting into Aleutian waters with burning car batteries aboard. He's also keeping an eye out for environmental hazards.
With the amount of fuel and hydraulics and everything else that's on that vessel, if it runs aground and causes a spill or something, that would be terrible for all of us.
The Coast Guard flew over the Morning Midas on Wednesday. There were no signs that it was taking on water or listing, and there are no reports of pollution in the water. The ship's location is being tracked remotely through its onboard satellite-connected systems. On Thursday, it was about 340 miles southwest of Adak, putting it in international waters. Once the ship is ready to be towed, Craig says he expects it to be brought back to Asia for repairs. The Morning Midas started its cross-Pacific journey in China late last month and was headed to Mexico. The ship's manager, Zodiac Maritime, chose salvage company Resolve Marine to respond to the fire. A tugboat with a team of salvage specialists is on its way and expected to arrive at the scene around Monday. Responders plan to send out another firefighting tugboat with towing capabilities. Adak is the westernmost municipality in the United States, about 400 nautical miles southwest of Unalaska. It's a former naval base with roughly 50 permanent residents today. Meanwhile, a terrorist group based in Nigeria has kidnapped a Catholic priest who previously served in Alaska, according to the Diocese of Fairbanks. The diocese announced on Monday that Boko Haram reported they captured Reverend Alphonsus Afina Sunday. On Thursday, the Catholic faith-based Fetus News Agency reported that religious officials in Nigeria were able to speak with Afina on the phone after his capture and said he was in good health at the time of the call. Fairbanks Diocese Vicar General Robert Fath says Afina, who's from Nigeria, came to Alaska in 2017 on a religious worker visa. Fath described Afina as welcoming, friendly, and open. He says Afina and another reverend had shared stories about prior encounters with Boko Haram.
You know, they had experienced personally, prior to being here, attempts on their lives. They had seen churches burned, family and friends that were kidnapped and killed.
Boko Haram is a jihadist militant group founded in Maiduguri, Nigeria in 2002. Before returning to Nigeria, Afina spent 6.5 years serving in Fairbanks and villages in Western Alaska. And Fath says he pursued a counseling degree while he was here.
His bishop asked him to return to Nigeria this past spring in April of 2024 in order to help found a crisis center for victims of the Boko Haram.
Fath says a service to pray for Afina's safe return was organized Tuesday at Sacred Heart Cathedral in Fairbanks and drew 200 people and more online. It'll be months until there's data showing how political and economic forces shaped 2025 travel plans to Alaska, but anecdotally, businesses and communities are already feeling the impact. It's early in the season, but as Alaska Public Media's Ava White reports, some parts of the state aren't seeing the tourist traffic or dollars they're used to.
The yellow umbrella that tops David Vargas's food cart has been a staple in downtown Anchorage for over a decade. His spot on 4th Avenue is a tourism hotspot in the summer, but he says it's been really slow this year.
Our sales are really low, and we have to, you know, we have to try to survive here. And we see our community too, they depend on the tourists too, and they are really slow. Restaurants, I'm not the only one.
He says sales this year so far are similar to 2020, when travel restrictions spurred by the COVID pandemic turned tourist hubs into ghost towns. Political tensions have caused some international travelers to cancel their vacations to Alaska. And nationally, spending on airfare and lodging has fallen in recent months, according to Bank of America's April Consumer Checkpoint, which says the dip is possibly due to declining consumer confidence and worries about the economic outlook. Industry leaders are bringing up a common theme about this summer.
Now, as we enter into our busiest season, uncertain is really the only word that sums it up nicely.
Julie Soppy is president and CEO of Visit Anchorage. In a March report prepared for the assembly, the organization said the industry was bracing for headwinds, including inflation, economic downturns, and an uncertain outlook for international visitors. Soppy says businesses in the state's largest city started the year with strong booking numbers for the summer season, but since mid-February, bookings have slowed dramatically. Overall, she's expecting Anchorage will see a slight decrease in visitor numbers this summer compared to the last.
No growth or a little bit of lower numbers is never anything you want to see, and it's hard to make plans as if you're a business. So I think we'll have an okay summer. I think it could have been a great summer, and that's where the disappointment falls.
In Southeast Alaska, the tourism season is generally optimistic about this year. According to an annual business survey conducted by Raincoast Data that over 400 business leaders contributed to. But uncertainty is weighing on tourism-dependent businesses and communities. Melanie Shivens is the owner and director of Raincoast. She says cruise passengers are arriving in large numbers, but they may not be spending as much.
I think that the concern is that visitors that are coming off the cruise ships seem to have a greater sensitivity towards pricing, so less people booking those high-end tours in advance. The survey was done pre-season, but they were looking at those advanced bookings, and they seem to be way down from prior years.
According to the survey, Airbnb hosts say bookings are down, and a tour operator says people are canceling tours. About 45 miles from the Canadian border, Haines has seen over a dozen cruise ships so far this season. The town is accessible by road, which brings visitors and their cash from both Alaska and Canada. Reba Hilton is the tourism director in Haines, where she's heard from Canadians who won't be visiting the town this summer.
We are used to quite a bit of road traffic, and it is so much quieter this year.
Haines hosts three events every summer that Hilton says usually lures a stream of Canadian visitors. The first was a beer festival in May, which typically draws a crowd from all corners of the continent. But ticket sales for that event were down over 20% this year, she says.
That really is unheard of. It's the kind of festival where your friends are looking for tickets at the last minute, and you can kind of count on always being able to get rid of your tickets if something comes up and you can't attend, because it does historically all sell out.
In Haines, they're preparing for the 150-mile Kluane-Chilkat International Bike Race at the end of June. Hilton says entries are down about the same amount for that event, too.
We're feeling the loss already. But at this point, it's still really early, and the Beer Fest was my first big, like, we're going to have some data from it. And knowing that that one particular event was down 20% is it's a little alarming.
She says the city's tourism account on social media, which she runs, has fielded comments from international travelers saying they're boycotting travel to the town and won't return until President Trump leaves office. In Anchorage, I'm Ava White.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
The Sitka Sound Science Center has a new resident. She's called a stubby squid, and as KCAW's Meredith Reddick reports, the miniature mollusk is rare to find, both in the wild and in an aquarium.
In a corner tank in the Sitka Sound Science Center, there's a soft creature the size and shape of a plum. She's a deep, ruddy purple, and when I approach the glass, she blasts a tiny puff of sand in my direction.
And she definitely sees us, so she's now blowing back at us to try and tell us to back up.
Matt Wilson has worked as the aquarist here for a few years. He manages the care of about 200 species in the aquarium, including this stubby squid. Despite the name, she is not actually a squid.
With every, you know, group of animals, there's some weirdos. So the stubby squid, or the dumpling squids, also known as bobtail squids, are related to cuttlefish. They are most closely related to cuttlefish, more than they are squid or octopus. But they are not quite cuttlefish.
Wilson found the stubby squid by accident. In March, he was walking along the beach next to the Science Center, looking for live crabs to feed to aquarium animals, when he noticed her.
I think she was trying to go after shrimp that were eating the herring eggs right after herring spawn. And so she was only in a couple inches of water when I spotted her on the beach.
Stubby squid usually live in deeper waters and burrow in the sand during the day. Wilson says finding one out in the open was a sign she was in bad shape.
So she was a dark purple, which means that all of her color-changing cells had completely relaxed. So she probably was almost sort of unconscious at the time.
He scooped her up in a bucket and brought her inside. Over several days, he adjusted the temperature and salt levels in her tank to better resemble her typical habitat. On the third day, she changed color and started burrowing again.
That was our first sign that she probably was going to start to improve.
It was a fortuitous outcome. Wilson just happens to be one of a handful of aquarium biologists with experience caring for this species. He first worked with them more than a decade ago.
It was about probably 4 years of off and on working with these animals before I really felt like I was getting positive, good interactions with them.
Wilson learned from guidelines left by the late octopus specialist Roland Anderson, who cared for stubby squid during his three-decade career at the Seattle Aquarium. Today, that's one of the only public aquariums that displays the species.
They're a species that not a lot of people get to see.
Catherine Cagle is a curator at the Seattle Aquarium. She says stubby squid don't often show up in aquariums because they can be hard to find, they don't live long, and they're really picky eaters.
They hunt small crustaceans and don't always like to eat dead food.
Cagle says reviving an unhealthy stubby squid, like the one Wilson found, could be especially difficult.
You know, the fact that you can find one that is not doing very well, that has washed up on the beach, and then take it back and essentially give it what it needs, that's pretty awesome.
For Wilson, keeping the stubby squid alive and happy is a lot of work. Today she's due for a feeding, which means Wilson has to pull shrimp pots to collect the live dock shrimp that she prefers. He doesn't often get to watch her hunt, but when he does, it's quite a show.
They pop up completely out of the sand, start to basically hover and rise just above the sand and shoot those tentacles out really, really quickly, like just lightning speed.
Stubby squid typically live for 1.5 to 2 years. Wilson says this particular pint-sized predator was already full-sized when he found her. He estimates she has another 4 to 6 months left.
That's the downside to working with cephalopods, is that they don't live for very long in most cases.
He considers his relationship with the animals as a collaboration, and he says that's why he avoids giving pet names to animals in his care.
These are not my pets. These are my colleagues.
He hopes to expand the existing care manual for the species, sharing what he's learned so other biologists can effectively care for this not quite a squid, not quite a cuttlefish creature. In Sitka, I'm Meredith Reddick.
Fairbanks marathon runner Jane Lanford is celebrating her 70th birthday by running 70 miles. She and her husband drove to the Denali Highway this morning. She'll spend the next 3 days running through the mountains and raise a little money for charity as well. KUAC's Robin reports.
Jane Lanford had just gotten back from a run yesterday when she talked about her plans for the weekend.
I'm perpetually training for marathons because I've run multiple marathons a year for a number of years. So I figure if I can do a 26-mile marathon, I can probably put 3 days together of that distance.
She'll run and walk in the morning and put in a little more than 20 miles each day. Her husband, Steve, is her logistical support, towing a camping trailer to sleep in, doing the cooking, and making sure she has water along the way. Running 70 miles for her 70th birthday is not a new idea. This will be the 5th year in a row of birthday runs.
We enjoyed the first time so much when I ran the entirety of the Denali Highway over 4 days that we kept doing it. It was like, well, we could do Top of the World Highway. We could do the Highway to Eagle. We could run to Circle.
This time she's back on the Denali Highway, but doing only half of it and going west to east. She'll start near the Alpine Creek Lodge and finish up in Paxson, where the road intersects with the Richardson Highway. She may even have some friends join her on some of it, but some are daunted by the weather forecast. The outlook is for temps in the 30s and 40s and heavy rain, something Lanford has not had to deal with on any of her long runs.
I can sit in the truck for a while if a really bad front comes through. We know that I don't want to sit for too long because it's really hard to get the legs going again.
Lanford is also taking donations on her Facebook page for Shelterbox USA, an international disaster relief organization she learned about through her Rotary Club. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Ashlyn O'Hara and Ava White in Anchorage, Shelby Herbert, Patrick Gilchrist, and Robin in Fairbanks, Clarice Larson in Juneau, Andy Lusk in Unalaska, and Meredith Reddick in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Annie Fite produced tonight's show. And I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
IBEW's path to success includes excellent training, good wages, benefits, and a comfortable retirement. Join the IBEW and build a bright future. Call 907-575-7285 to find out more. This message sponsored by IBEW Local 1547.
Sustaining membership offers public media greater financial stability month to month, so consider making a sustaining gift to this station. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide.
saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can't break your heart, when you're down so low you cannot fall, would you change? Would you change? How bad, how good does it need to get? How many losses, how much regret? What chain reaction would cause an effect? Makes you turn around, makes you try to explain, makes you forgive and forget, makes you change.
say. I only hear what I want to. You say I talk so all the time. So
on the truth, not just dead.